Doctor, would you see evidence of a relationship between vaccination and autism in the case in which a child suffered an acute encephalopathy 9 days after an MMR vaccination and was followed by and that encephalopathy was immediately followed by symptoms of regressive autism?
No, I wouldn't, particularly without being able to look at the facts of the case. I think it's the overwhelming likelihood in that instance is that the child is mislabeled.
If there were a subclass of children with regressive autism whose clinical profile was truly distinctive, would their clinical profile be relevant to the etiology of their autism?
Potentially. That's why we try to designate things as carefully as we can as subcategories to see whether there is within a larger group, a smaller group that might have some particular vulnerability. But it would not include children that have the onset of their disease in the pattern of regressive autism because of an insult occurring in the second year of life. Could not be, because that's not the way in which the genetic code that's leading to the disorder would work its way out.
What is childhood disintegrative disorder?
Well, it was described a long time ago, back in the 20s, and there still are occasional cases of childhood disintegrative disorder that go under that heading, and we do see children that have this significant deterioration at later stages of life. It is not it is not regressive autism. It has its own particular manifestations, and that's a different condition, and one that's rare and has been insufficiently studied.
Do you believe that the difference in the age of onset and prognosis in childhood disintegrative disorder suggests a different etiology for childhood disintegrative disorder as opposed to regressive autism?
It's possible, as I say. It's a rare condition despite its description so very long ago, and it is not autism. It is something separate.
Do you believe that environmental factors play a significant role in the evolution or the causation of childhood disintegrative disorder?
As I say, it's still unknown, it can readily be set apart from cases like the present one, where it's classic regressive autism. It has its own natural history that needs to be better understood. The trouble with that particular disorder is that the rare cases that are described in insufficient detail to know for sure what in the world people are talking about. And that goes back to Heller's original description, which is a few cases in the 1920s, additional descriptions in the late 1940s, and then some subsequent cases. We need to come to a better understanding of that syndrome, distinct from the current one we're dealing with here.
Is it an autism spectrum disorder?
It's been included in that spectrum. There are a lot of apples and oranges in the autistic spectrum designation. And whether some of them share pathogenesis with autism or not is not entirely clear.
How much of the testimony that you shared on the anatomy of autism is based on pathological examinations of brains?
All of the pathology I spoke about is based on the pathological analysis. The functional MR studies are based on anatomic observations in regions where pathology has been observed.
Do you know the typical age of the individual from whom the brains were taken?
Yeah, that's an important point. Typically, brains don't become available until individuals are much older. Autism is associated with a normal lifespan, so is Rett syndrome in most instances, and so it's not until individuals are older when the brain can be studied in that way. This is why it's been so important to observe those regional pathological observations, and find out whether they're true of younger individuals. And that's what functional MR is doing. In order to demonstrate that there is a consistency between those pathological observations and the onset of disease earlier. If one observes, however, in pathological specimens, abnormal development of brain, we can generally time that fairly well because we know when these things manifest themselves, these developmental effects. And so finding a dysgenesis in the brain, we have an abundant amount of information about when the onset of dysgenetic elements take place. And as in this instance, the dysgenetic changes in the many columns occur early, and so they're early childhood manifestations. The somewhat dissimilar changes that are seen on the basis of intrauterine effects have to take place early as well, and that so they can be timed with regard to when we know that normal development takes place.
With regard to the pathological examination of brains, is it fair to say it's often hard to tell whether you're finding the cause or the consequence of a disorder when you look at the samples?
The important next step, I think I mentioned, once you observe something pathologically, is to compare that to the known function of that portion of the brain and find out at what period in a person's life that dysfunction manifested itself. In doing this, we find that the pathology that Dr. Bowman and others have observed is in keeping with the timing of development of regression, for example, in regressive autism. So we have very sound evidence that the timing is at the time that the child, or prior to the time that the child has provided those manifestations of autism.
With regard to the MRI, what other MRIs, PET scans, and other computer imaging of the brain that in which you describe the pathology and the physiology of autism, what was the typical age of the persons that were scanned for those exams?
Some early childhood scans, some older individuals were also scanned, and so additional information is likely to be necessary, but we know for pretty dead certain when these changes occur in terms of cortical development, because the timing of cortical development and the timing of onset of dysgenetic portions of cortex has been worked out in the brains of individuals of all ages. So this, in large series of patients who've had their brains examined after their death at varied ages, both from the Perinatal Collaborative Project for small children that died, and from older individuals for at least 50 years, or more like 70 years, we know the sequence with which certain aspects of cortical development occur. And so we have a very good time frame within which to place the timing of brain development.
In your opinion, what percent of children with regressive autism have gastrointestinal problems that merit a colostomy? I'm saying that colonostomy. I'm saying that, excuse me, colonoscopy. Excuse me for my articulation deficit. How many, roughly, how common is it for that procedure to be necessary, reasonably necessary for a child with autism?
It's uncommon in my experience.
I'm sorry?
It's uncommon in my experience.
How common is it for children with regressive autism to require pancreatic enzymes?
The word "require" is a difficult one for me. I have plenty of patients who are on pancreatic enzymes that, if I were their pediatrician, I wouldn't be giving it to them. So it's difficult to know.
Do you have any idea of how many children with regressive autism are prescribed pancreatic enzymes and gastrointestinal medication designed to reduce inflammation in the intestines by a well-qualified pediatric gastroenterologist?
I know of patients that are treated in this way and have oftentimes wondered whether it's the right thing to have done for whoever did it. Usually in those instances, the gastrointestinal complaints in the patients that I've seen don't really merit that sort of intervention so far as I'm concerned. And at least as regards our gastroenterologist at the University of Virginia, I believe that their opinion is similar to mine.
So would it be fair to say that, in your opinion, the children with progressive autism who, in fact, need a colonoscopy and, in fact, require pancreatic enzymes and anti-inflammatory medication for their intestines is rare? Small?
Well, I would say that it's rare in my experience. If one were to decide that this designates a separate subcategory of children with autism and one wished to study it, the important first step would be to have independent confirmation by other gastroenterologists that this, in fact, was a necessary step and was in some way justified. At least in my opinion, having taken care of a lot of children as a pediatrician, a child that's growing well and maintaining weight at the 95th percentile and having no other significant medical difficulties, it would seem to me that somebody is likely overreaching.
You reviewed the medical records for the February 8th, 2001 doctor's visit, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
Yates was ill, wasn't he?
I'd have to be refreshed on the details of that particular day. I'd be happy to take a look at that record.
Under what circumstances did you, as a pediatrician, prescribe antibiotics to a child with an ear infection?
I probably did it much less often than some other pediatricians and as often as many pediatricians, which is seldom. Almost all of the time, inner ear infections in children are caused by viruses. They're almost always occurring in association with coryza and other upper respiratory illnesses. And almost all of the time, they get better without antibiotics. And almost all of the time, parents don't give the full 10-day course of antibiotics. So it's an over-treatment issue.
So I'm trying to understand, your practice differed from that of some pediatricians?
I'm sure it is. There are people that do all kinds of things in the world.
Under what circumstances would it be appropriate for a pediatrician to give a child antibiotics for an ear infection?
If they felt that there was pus in the inner ear, if they felt there was considerable amount of detraction of movement of the, or interference with movement of the drum, it could be considered in those instances. If the child had high fever and one were concerned about the possibility that that's a manifestation of a bacterial illness, it could be considered there as well. But most of the time, it's virus.
Would a child need, I'm trying to get the sense, if you can, maybe my question doesn't make sense, and tell me if it doesn't. Would the child's illness need to be more than mild? Or would it have to be a fairly, at least a moderately severe ear infection before antibiotics should be considered?
Well, purists used to puncture the eardrum, even in cases where there was a considerable amount of reddening, in order to obtain some material, do a slide, and so forth. But puncturing the eardrum of a child that's struggling and so forth is an awkward procedure. Many people settle with the fact that if the child seems more ill, perhaps we'll give some antibiotics. Antibiotics are not entirely safe, but generally safe. Overuse of antibiotics contributes to other problems downstream. So the evidence would be that in most instances, even in a child that has a fever of a fair degree, that the virus is causing the problem and that antibiotics are going to play no role in treatment. The one instance, I suppose, when I do end up thinking antibiotics are more appropriate, if the child has a runny nose with the purulent discharge from the nose, that's bacterial overgrowth in a viral situation. Whether the antibiotic plays any role in making that better is not clear, but it's one of the times when I'll give antibiotics.
In your commentary on the description of the onset of Yates' autism in your report, why did you omit reference to the records that described his regression as beginning at 12 months of age?
My comments were on Dr. Corbière's report chiefly, and that's where my attention was directed.
Do you know or by reputation Dr. Zimmerman?
I don't know Dr. Zimmerman.
Do you know his reputation as a physician to teach kids with autism?
I've heard of him.
Did you review Dr. Zimmerman's report concerning the onset of Yates' autism?
I believe I did.
That's all the questions I have.
I have no redirect. Thank you.
I do have a few questions, Dr. Rast. You have referenced several times in your testimony and on your slide classic regressive autism. Are you using that term as being one and the same thing?
Oh, thank you, Special Master. I would like to make that point clear. We distinguish the classic form, which has its earlier onset, from the regressive form, typically in the second year of life. And the hyphen that I placed between those two designations was meant to suggest that as we look closely, we see typically that there are some abnormalities. I wouldn't say it that strongly. We can only do this in instances where the family can provide us with preceding videotapes or CDs, and they can do that increasingly for us because so many tapes are taken of babies. And when we look closely at those tapes, we see children that aren't entirely normal, oftentimes even prior to the point at which the parents have really noted a significant change in the child. So they're not entirely distinct from each other, these two categories, but they are distinguished from one another very reliably by the fact that the children are not so severely impaired as those children we call classic autism.
You also reference in your expert opinion, you use the term CPRL, conventional peer-reviewed literature.
Yes.
Would you describe what your view of CPRL is?
Yes, I made the term up, I'm afraid, but it was the best way I could deal with a mixed literature on a subject. The term conventional is used in other ways in Dr. Corbière's report. Perhaps I'm imprecise in a way too, but I really do mean something specific by it. What I mean is the medical literature where the process of review of articles is undertaken by known experts in the field who read those articles carefully to make sure that the method of the research, the manner in which it's carried out, the appropriacy of that manner, and the interpretation of results are all done with the care that we need in papers that are brought to our attention. There's so much in the medical literature, it's overwhelming to all of us to keep up. It's very helpful that this well-worked-out process of review is there so that we at least are starting with those papers that have adhered to what are the usual standards. They now involve not only knowledge on the part of the reviewer and not only a very careful review by several, two, three, four, five reviewers sometimes, but then the process that's very important of providing that information to the author of the paper so that in papers where there are problems, but there's a kernel of information that's of some importance, or information you can't get elsewhere, that those papers be improved and then published. So there's that teaching aspect of critical review, and catching any mistakes and catching any things that are mislabeled. All those things are done by the careful reviewer. And that's the point at which it then enters the large collection of medical literature, where we know that there are some journals that are more reliable than others. We keep up with those more closely than others. It doesn't mean we ignore a paper that happens to be somewhere where it is less impact, especially if that's an area where there aren't so many papers. But it allows us to get on with the process of keeping up and revising our opinions. And knowing that the information upon which we're spending what time we have is time comparatively well spent. There is yet another aspect in that, especially over the last 10 to 15 years, the peer-reviewed literature has taken excruciating pains to make sure that there's no conflict of interest on the part of those publishing the papers, and that they're not in any way going to gain financially from the report that they're providing. All this must be attested to by the authors of the paper, that all of the authors have participated appropriately, and that the methods that are described in the papers are ones that they would stand by in a courtroom if they had to say that this is what they've done. So that's why we rely on that literature.
Dr. Cormier relied on a number of articles in support of reading reference. I believe his characterization of several studies support his proposition. What is your view of those articles?
Well, he's obviously spent a great deal of time thinking and worrying about this case, and if something has come to his attention that that I'm not aware of that would alter my opinion, I know he's said he's going to provide those articles, and I'd be very happy to review them to see if there's anything that would cause me to think otherwise. It's terribly important in medicine to keep an open mind. If you don't, you're going to miss something, or you're going to continue to practice in a way in which things are not quite correct. I would say that for 20-some years now, I've tried to keep up with this as with other literatures and have a reasonably comprehensive view of something that's very important to me. I would be happy to look at anything else that anybody would like to bring to my attention, however.
One final question. You referred very early in your testimony to the spectrum of autism disorders. You've described, you clarified your reference to classic versus regressive. What neurological disorders do you think probably fall within the range of autism spectrum disorders?
Well, a wide variety of disorders have been placed there. Some just go under the designation of autistic spectrum or other diseases that seem to have autistic qualities to them. This has not been a very helpful approach, in my view. And the labels that are applied are oftentimes inaccurate, and sometimes we're missing something. There's a problem with applying a label to somebody. If we know exactly what we're talking about, applying that label is appropriate. There are times when labels related to autism and autistic spectrum disorders are provided in the medical community for the sake of provision of services. This is in instances where children require the understanding of patient teachers who give the student who's having difficulties special time. I think that many or perhaps most teachers do this anyway, but there are particular skills that are required for students that have behavioral issues in relationship to other things. And sometimes we know that the teacher that has those special qualities that make them a teacher of children with autism will give them that advantage. So I must say that sometimes we apply these labels imprecisely for that reason. On the other hand, children get labels related to their behavior, their development, their capacities, and their capabilities in ways that I think are not helpful. We have an over-labeling of children in general nowadays with all kinds of initial disorders. And so I've become increasingly careful about the labels that I apply to children because it doesn't help to have them in a category. And that's what I'd say about that.
With that said, your focus in terms of what would be regarded as autistic behavior would turn on the core features that you addressed earlier?
Yes, that's exactly right. With the categories of classic autism and regressive autism being very distinct, very carefully worked out, very, very repetitive in terms of the combination of symptoms and signs and, that are present in the children. There are still other things to look at and are being looked at. And then the children with, that get the Asperger's designation, which is applied more imprecisely than the other disorders. But is one that is very distinctive. And then there are other things that are found within the spectrum of disorders that probably are separate illnesses. So we use other labels for those.
Thank you, Dr. Lowe.
Thank you, Special Master.
Have my questions triggered any questions from counsel?
No, thank you.
Well, I have, but it depends on when you count them. They're either three or four, or two or four. Several times in your testimony and in your slides, you listed classic and regressive autism. Are they the same thing in your mind?
No, they're different from one another. There just happens to be an earlier onset of some of the features of regressive autism, of indistinct onset, which is a little different than what we usually have designated as the onset of regressive autism.
In your opinion, are there different genetic or environmental factors involved in the causation of classic as opposed to regressive autism?
I don't think that environmental factors are involved at all in any way, and I can say that with 99% confidence, I believe. But with regard to the cause, it could be different genes. It could be a different combination of genes. It could be gene dose, such that some children have a greater dose of the genetic problem. We know that that's true with the CCMET problem with genetic determination of autism. The more copies you get, if you get two copies instead of one, you have earlier onset of manifestations. So there are, without doubt, genetic determinants for the onset of these things. It is possible that that dose of other things that are experienced in the childhood environment in the uterus play a role, and this may have to do with imprinting or with hormonal effects in keeping with the currently very interesting but as yet unproven set of hypotheses that surround the male theory of mind approach to autism. As was mentioned, one intrauterine infection produces something that resembles autism, and that's congenital rubella. That illness as well can likely be distinguished from classic autism, even though its onset of manifestations is after birth.
Yeah, several of the slides that described pathological and physiological characteristics of autism had that classic and regressive autism label on them. Were the samples studied systematically classified as either classic or regressive in these studies?
Yes, Dr. Bowman's studies have tried to distinguish the patients on the basis of the time of onset of their illness.
Were any of those studies cited in your report?
No, I don't believe they were, but I could provide those citations.
In fact, your report didn't go into much detail on the anatomy or physiology of autism, did it?
I was asked to address Dr. Corbiere's report, and that's what I did.
You weren't asked to give a report that would give a preview of your testimony that wasn't a direct response to Dr. Corbiere?
That wasn't my understanding of what I was meant to do.
That's all the questions I have. It was more than four, and I apologize.
I have no follow-up. Thank you.
Thank you, Special Master.
I think this leaves us with our day today, and we are to anticipate a 10:30 commencement time, anticipating a late arrival of Dr. McCusker and McDonald this evening. It is further my understanding, brace yourself, that tomorrow may be our longest day yet. We're anticipating the testimony of both Dr. McCusker and Dr. McDonald and any concluding statements that counsel wish to make, and I've seated our courtroom for Friday. So we'll run through until 9 p.m. and possibly, if that's required, and possibly walk out with the sheriffs tomorrow evening will be our thought. So until tomorrow, we're in recess at 10:30. Thank you.